After nearly a decade overseas as a war reporter, acclaimed journalist Dar Jamal returned to America to renew his passion for mountaineering, only to find that the slopes he had once climbed had been irrevocably changed by climate disruption. In response, Dar embarks on a journey to the geographical front lines of the crisis, from Alaska to Australia's Great Barrier Reef via the Amazon rainforest, in order to discover the consequences to nature and to humans of the loss of ice. His new book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Destruction. So, Dar, maybe just a little bit, I guess you're a big mountaineer. What were you finding up there as you began to go after your various mountains?
Well, what I found, and this was back in the mid-90s, shortly after I moved up to Alaska, and what I found was the immediate and obvious impacts of severe climate change, of dramatically receding glaciers, dramatically shrinking glaciers in terms of volume, very, very unseasonably warm temperatures across parts of Alaska for much of the year, and things like going through Christmas in Anchorage with no snow on the ground in Anchorage, Alaska. So, some really immediate and apparent impacts of a pretty dramatic climate change, and of course making itself the most evident in the glacial areas, which now the scientists that I've interviewed for my book said, you know, these are the real canaries in the coal mine. If you really want to see the impacts of climate change, look at how fast the glaciers are receding.
The International Panel on Climate Change recently warned in their report that the world has 12 years left for unprecedented action to avoid climate disaster. Do you think that is too optimistic?
I do. I've actually written about that because there's no data in that report that the UN released sounding this alarm. And let me preface this by saying, I'm really glad that they sounded the alarm. I'm really glad that it served to wake a lot of people up that probably weren't paying close enough attention. But the point is, them making this statement that we already have 12 years is inaccurate for several reasons. Certainly plenty of the scientists that I spoke with working on my book would directly refute it. One of them, for example, Dr. Harold Wanless, says, he's a sea level rise expert down at University of Miami, and he said, look, the oceans have already absorbed 93% of all the heat we've generated in the atmosphere. You're not going to get that warming out of the oceans, and now they are driving a lot of these runaway feedback loops, like the recent dramatic studies that have been published and released in just the last few weeks. One about the Antarctic, how melting across there has increased sixfold since just the 1970s. Another study about Greenland, how, again, ice loss there and melting has accelerated very, very dramatic in recent years. And this is all due primarily because of oceanic warming and these ice sheets being melted from below. And not even speak of other impacts of the warming oceans, like the decline of coral reefs around the world, the displacement of marine species, and things like this. So we're looking at a situation where there's already enough heat baked into the system, which is how a lot of scientists refer to these phenomena, that even if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions on a dime and engaged in the biggest mitigation we could possibly do globally with government coordination, that we're still looking at probably a minimum of a 3C temperature increase by 2100, which by all counts is already catastrophic runaway climate change.
Now, Dora, your phone reception is not the world's greatest. I don't know if there's anything you can do about keeping in one spot or trying to improve that a bit. So you mentioned the melting of like the Antarctic and, you know, other ice shelves. What would that mean in terms of sea rise, even in, you know, say, the next century or so?
Well, I'll cite the professor who I just named, Dr. Harold Wanless, who's one of the leading experts on sea level rise. And he warned, and this is also backed by a scientific study that was published and cited by Dr. James Hansen a little ways back, that said by 2050, we could possibly see as much as 10 feet of sea level rise. And that is incongruence with the fact that the last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels in the geologic past, sea levels were between 60 and 70 feet higher than they are right now today, which means basically we've already made these tweaks to the global climate system and added so much CO2 to the atmosphere that we're basically just waiting on the Earth to catch up. Dr. Wanless also mentioned that we could see as much as 20 feet by 2100. And while that seems a bit extreme, if we look at the IPCC projections and how every time they have a new assessment report come out, they are dramatically increasing their worst-case prediction. And one of the reasons they're doing so is because these projections have not been keeping pace with reality, that literally things are moving along so fast at this point that worst-case projections made by the IPCC have not kept the pace with it. And one of the ways that that's played itself out is specifically on sea level rise. And so we talk about these giant ice sheets in Greenland and some of them, mostly in the Antarctic, and some of them in Greenland, and they are melting from below. Those out over the ocean, as the oceans are warming, that is one of the main drivers of this acceleration that we're seeing today.
Most Americans now believe in the reality of climate change, more or less, but few treat it as a major priority. And what are some things about climate change that we just don't grasp, particularly those feedback loops that you mentioned?
Well, it is specifically the feedback loops. And it's I think the hardest thing for all of us to grasp is the nonlinear nature of the changes now. I mean, I think our minds are kind of built along this timeline of, you know, do A, get B, and then things are going to progress along a timeline in a linear fashion. And the reality is that's not really the case anymore, that things, instead of kind of starting out maybe going in a linear fashion, are now actually moving along at a pace where things are increasing exponentially. So it's not, we're going to see a predictable amount of sea level rise that as these different loops kick in. So, for example, with the melting now of these ice sheets that's happening from below as the oceans warm, that wasn't really seen as a major factor even 10 years ago. Some people were warning about it and looking into it, but now it's become common knowledge that, you know, this is a huge, huge issue, and this is going to be speeding things along now much, much faster than we predicted. And we hadn't even been really factoring that in as a major factor even just a short while ago. And numerous other feedback loops that are kicking in. One, for example, as subsea permafrost across the Arctic is melting, which contains frozen methane frozen into it, as the ice sheet, the summer ice sheet, summer sea ice, rather, of the Arctic is diminishing, it exposes more of that water to absorb solar radiation rather than it being reflected back into space when the ice. That then warms that water that much faster, which is then starting to thaw out the subsea permafrost, which is then releasing the methane in it, which then, of course, warms the atmosphere faster and then feeds all of those cycles that much more intensely. So that's another feedback loop that's already been kicked in. And some scientists are now pointing to as many as several dozen of these feedback loops that have been kicked in. And so not only are they positive self-reinforcing feedback loops, but then they also reinforce one another. And that's even with a nonlinear fashion kicks into overdrive.
So, Dora, I'm curious how other, you know, climate journalists and scientists react to some of your, you know, conclusions. Do they find you too far out there or, you know, mainstream? Or, you know, what's been sort of the reaction to your publications?
Well, I would say it's mixed. A lot of the scientists that I talk about, all of, you know, connecting all of these dots together, think that I don't go far enough. that they think it's far, far worse than I even allude to in the book, and that we actually have a much shorter time frame before global level catastrophic shifts start to really make themselves more apparent. Others think, well, no, you can't go that far because as far as, you know, connecting all these dots, because we just don't know. There's still so much that we don't know yet. So I would say that it's mixed, but I would say as far as mainstream journalism, it's also mixed insofar as if you look at, for example, some of the climate reporting in the Washington Post and the New York Times in the last year, it's actually really picked up speed, and I would tip my hat to it, because they're the ones that have been really making it a point to bring attention to a lot of these really dire scientific studies that are coming out, a couple of which I cited earlier. And I think that that's worthy of kudos, whereas if you look at TV, really, I can't point to one single television news outlet that's really doing even half the job that needs to be done as far as climate reportage. But it is a subject. I actually take heart in the fact that in the last year, particularly in the U.S., because there have been so many extreme weather events and wildfires, et cetera, that people are being forced into starting to give it the amount of coverage and the accuracy of coverage that it certainly is earned by this time.
And do you feel any optimism from recent actions called for by Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Sunrise Movement for a Green New Deal?
I certainly applaud the effort. I don't know that I draw optimism from it, because it's still just an idea, and a lot would have to happen for it to become enacted as legislation, as law. But I think that the idea and the urgency behind it, and the energy and the youth and all of that, and everything in the new Green Deal, not just the climate aspect, but the economic justice and all the rest, I think it's absolutely fabulous legislation. And it's the kind of legislation and the urgency and the scope that we need to be bringing to bear, without a doubt.
So what do people, need to do, about climate change at this point, other than, jumping off the roof in despair?
Well, it's a moment in history where I certainly have made it a point not to try to tell anybody what to do or make any kind of overarching statements, because what I've had to do is really reconnect myself back into the planet, go to the place where I listen, go to the place where I really feel the most connected in with Earth, and really listen. And for me, that manifested itself in this book, and I knew that I needed to write this book to bring this information together and get it out to a broader audience. And I think everyone's going to have a very different reaction, and I think the first thing all of us have to do is going to be go through a bit of a grieving process when we really come to terms with the intensity and the magnitude of what all of this means. And then what are we going to do about it? But before that, we have to go through all these feelings. That's going to necessitate community and bringing our friends and our loved ones close in and have very serious conversations. And then deciding what is our role going to be? How are we best going to be able to serve the planet? And that doesn't mean everyone needs to go become a climate journalist or a climate activist, because we need gardeners. We need people building tiny houses for us to live in. We need people engaged in the medical profession to take care of us. I mean, we need everybody playing whatever role they feel deeply called to do. But I think we have to start with being honest and grieving what's happening. And then from that place of the clarity that will come from that, I think each one of us is going to know what we need to do.
What are some of the groups that you feel are effective on climate change?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is Extinction Rebellion. This is a group that launched over in the UK, where they're doing fantastic work raising awareness to the gravity of the crisis and the immediacy of it. And it's now become an international movement, and they do have parts of it now that are active in several cities across the United States. And like I said, it is global, it is international. And I think that is a great group. I think those, as you mentioned before, the Sunrise Movement, a lot of the folks behind the idea of the New Green Deal, there's a lot of great groups out there doing a lot of great, important work. And that's heartening, so that, you know, people are looking for a group to throw their weight behind and join up and see what they can do. At least there are some that are out there that I think really have a good idea of, you know, this is, we're out of time. It's a time to force governments to do what we know that they need to do if we're going to have any chance of mitigating things. And so it's, I take heart in the fact that at least these are already out there.
So, Dar, we want to thank you for joining us today. Your new book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. I guess you could probably just Google Dar and climate and come up with the book, but I assume it's on all the, you know, the various websites you can find it and stuff.
You bet. Yeah, you can pretty much pick it up wherever at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.